Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. Back in the 18 months when I was on YouTube, when I was finding my feet with YouTube videos, I started making more and more sophisticated videos, and I learned the ropes little by little. And in the time that I was on YouTube, I made three videos that began to take off. And you're about to see one of them that pleased me the most. Normally, with any video that you make or anything that you do on the internet, you get a bunch of people who watch it in the first few days, first week or so. But then the number of people who watch it go down. And this is the manner in which all things that you put on the internet work, that 90% of the views come in the first week, and then it trickles down and people forget about it, and very few people watch it afterwards. But on rare occasions, and I mean rare occasions, like you have to put out stuff for a year or more, on rare occasions, you will find that there's one thing that you put out, and after a time, it starts to get a life of its own, and it starts to climb more and more. In the case of my original website, African Crisis, the thing I had that went viral for the longest period of time was my farm murders page. And this was back in about 2003 to 2006. My farm murders page started gaining ground. Eventually, I even lost my hosting in America because of that farm murders page. But the farm murders page always drew interest and people kept coming back, at least for like 4 or 5 years nonstop. But this type of thing is extremely rare. However, when I was on YouTube, there were three videos that I made that began to go viral in this way. The one I've already put up, it's the one from Michael Collins Piper, and it's the video about how the Jews infiltrated the Roman Catholic Church and took it over. There was another one I did. It had to do with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, I think. And that was probably the only American political thing I did that started going viral. And like I say, you can see the trends normally, and you can see the trends are downhill. But then you have these strange, lucky videos that initially, maybe they go down for a while, but then after a time you start seeing they start gaining momentum, and then they go wild. And this particular video that I'm about to show you was the third one. And in all cases, I had access to the YouTube statistics, and I kept watching for weeks on end as these three videos at different times started going viral, and I could see they're starting to just gain momentum. Every day, every week, you just see this thing's just going up. And I was thinking, wow, you know, these videos could ultimately go totally viral and reach millions of people. And then I saw that all of a sudden, at a certain level, it starts getting killed. And then it gets brought down, and that's that. And lots of people spoke about shadow banning. Shadow banning originated on Twitter, and there was shadow banning on YouTube. You see, YouTube works on its own search engine. That's what makes YouTube so successful. It's got its own search engine. So once you get into that search engine will bring your thing to the attention of more and more people. But obviously, they have some mechanism to kill things off. Plus, of course, I began getting Jews lodging legal complaints against my videos. By the time that my YouTube channel was banned the first time, I had 700 or 800 legal complaints on YouTube. Legal complaints. In other words, some attorney has written to YouTube to complain about my videos. And that is how I got banned the first time. Then I did some tricky stuff to get back onto YouTube in order to try to get my audience and to get my audience off YouTube onto History Reviewed. And I was able to mess around on YouTube for 6 months before they banned all 10 channels that I'd created. But anyway, I reckoned that if they didn't do shadow banning and they didn't do all these weird things, plus there were lots of younger guys who did more investigation of shadow banning and so forth, and people could come forward with statistics and show all kinds of weird things that show that YouTube was tweaking your stuff. I reckoned that these videos of mine could eventually have reached millions of people. I reckon even that strange one that I did about Trump and Hillary Clinton, that's probably the only American political thing I've ever done that could have gone viral. But this video that you're about to see was definitely very successful, and it was going places. And that Michael Collins Piper video, same thing. These and many other experiences of mine add to my total and utter conviction that white people would never have been liberals if they weren't propagandized by Jews. White people would never have been liberals if they weren't heavily, intensely, insanely propagandized by Jews. This is true for Americans and Canadians. It's true for Europeans. There is not an ounce of doubt in my mind that whites would never have engaged in any of these anti-white things. If whites knew the facts, if white people knew the real facts about lots of things, whites would not have fought the Germans, lots of wars would not have happened, and definitely whites would never have been liberals. Whites would even have been Nazis. There were whites all over the Western world who were becoming Nazis and fascists in the 1920s. If it wasn't for Jews, there would be no such thing as liberalism. Liberalism, with its disgusting, ugly diversity, would never have existed. So when I see all the dirty tricks that have been used against whites to stop the message reaching whites, I'm absolutely, totally confident that white people are not suicidal and would never have been suicidal if it wasn't for freaking Jews. I also just want to make something clear about my videos. I don't just make videos for the fun of making videos. I don't choose videos based on their popularity. I don't choose videos on the basis of what is the most fun video to make at this point in time. I actually make videos while focusing on the things that I think white people need to hear the most, even if it's not popular. But now that I've got a lot of my old videos back, I will try and feed a mix of videos into my channels and websites to keep up a steady stream, and I will throw in all kinds of odds and sods in between the serious stuff that people need to hear. After I was thrown off YouTube, I went through a very complex rigmarole to try and see if I could get a website up for myself, to try and see if I could run videos off my own website, etc. And during that time, I didn't keep as careful track of my videos as I do nowadays. And I actually reached a point where I seemed to have lost a lot of videos. And I couldn't find them on my PC and on my disk drives and things. And this particular video that you're about to see was the video that I wanted to get back the most. This one and the Michael Collins Piper video. I found the Michael Collins Piper video quite a while back, a year or two ago, and put it online. But this particular one I really battled to find. I really was convinced up until about 2 months ago. I was absolutely convinced I would never find this video again. But in all my various behind the scenes work, as I was cleaning up my own stuff on my PCs and my discs, and I was cataloging things more accurately, I hunted again for this video, and to my utter amazement, I found it. I was so over the moon that I found it, and this was part of lots of things from the past that I've been finding. And just a week or two ago, I found another database that was missing, that was from websites that I ran from about 2013 to 2018. There wasn't much of interest on there, but there were a couple of things there that I also wanted to get. There was some South African stuff I wanted to get. So I've got tons of stuff now that I thought I'd lost. There is still one video that is outstanding. There is one video that I think I did make a video of, and that one I can't find. It never went viral, but it was another German World War II video. It might still be floating around because it might just be a case that I don't know what the name of the video is. So I'll keep hunting around, and now I also know where to look in between other videos. So maybe I will still find it. But it was a fun video, and it was a video about supermen in the night. It was about German supermen in the night, and it was about more British bullshit about World War II, just British lies about World War II. The British even lied to their bomber pilots. Their bomber pilots at a point were getting so scared of flying over Germany that they lied to their own pilots. And the reality was German supermen were busy blowing the British out of the sky. And that is a fantastic story. But I will look for it, and if I don't find it, I'll actually remake that little video because it's an amazing story. I've actually got tons and tons of German stuff as well as non-German stuff that I want to do, but we've got years of work ahead of us, so I will fit things in. And nowadays I work according to a much stricter, more planned schedule with my videos. So this video that I put it out in about 2016, and this video irritated people. I got more insults from this video on YouTube than anything else, and boy did it insult the British. But I didn't care, it's the truth. The British need to wake up and see things how they were rather than the propaganda. So the video you're about to see is totally unchanged, it's the total original. So I just want to make one or two comments before the video, and at the end of the video I just want to have a quick discussion about the final battle statistics for this battle. Because after the video I'm putting in a short documentary about that battle, and then I'll put in a little piece right at the end with the final casualty figures to clarify it. This is unquestionably the greatest tank battle in the history of the world. But be careful. Whenever these bastards write about World War II, they're always downplaying the wonderful achievements of the Germans. They are downplaying it, they're twisting things, they always try to write it in such a way, oh well, you know, there were a lot of tanks, but you know, it wasn't really a tank battle, blah blah blah, bunch of crap. And they're always busy with some kind of shit when it comes to stuff that the Germans were winning at. And there's another particular battle I'd like to tackle later about the Germans that is very important. It's a good lesson for whites. something I've been meaning to do for years. But anyway, my whole setup is more organized. So everything that's coming out is being planned, and I'm putting out at least 2 videos a week. So you'll just see droves of videos coming out, some of them old, some of them new, interviews, all kinds of things. But anyway, I will see to it that we get to some German topics in between other things. And the British also have their way of writing history where they downplay German stuff, they downplay their own failures, they try, and even there are even instances where they portray their failures as some kind of victory. Actually, the British do that. I've seen that with a bunch of things, where they've done something that's actually an abject failure, and they'll rewrite it as if it's some kind of victory. Meanwhile, the Germans will actually win a real battle against tremendous odds, and then people will like poo-poo it, and oh no, you know, oh, the Germans, you know, it wasn't really a battle. They just like walked in and nothing happened, had no resistance. And then you get a thing like Stalingrad, where they misrepresent so many aspects about Stalingrad. Stalingrad is a whole other topic by itself. We'll chat about it another day. But don't buy into all the crap that, Stalingrad was the beginning of the end, blah, blah. Shut up. You don't even know what the hell happened. And all these military things are so easy to twist out of context, etc., etc. So I just want to discuss a few simple things about the Germans and their tanks at the beginning of the war so that you can see a few things before you watch this battle, because this pertains to this battle, which was early in 1941. It was in July 1941, the greatest tank battle in the history of the world, won decisively by the Germans. If you look on this screen, on the screen image in front of you, by the way, on the top left, I've got some Waffen SS soldiers with their camouflage, the first ever troops in the history of the world to use proper camouflage uniforms. And you'll see that German soldier with that machine gun. I'm assuming it's an MG42. And that soldier is like a soldier's soldier. Just look at his face, look at his bearing. These are real soldiers. These are probably the greatest soldiers that have walked the earth since the French under Napoleon, or the Prussians under Frederick, or the Romans. These are serious and insanely awesome Germans. They are just mind-blowingly awesome. You are looking at real supermen, not garbage. Real supermen. True men, the greatest of the greatest that white men can be. Now, in the top right of this image, take a look at those panzers. In this battle, there were lots and lots of light tanks. Early in the war, there were a lot of concepts in all armies. There were concepts of the light tank. And the initial German army was composed of things like Panzer I's, Panzer II's. And if you look at a Panzer I and a Panzer II, they are like that tank that you see there. These tanks are many times often even just armed with machine guns. They aren't even tanks, they're actually armored cars. They can't even destroy another tank. So you'll have hundreds of these vehicles that appear to be tanks, but they're actually like armored cars. And it seems that the Germans have then got a couple of other heavier tanks, like Panzer III's and even Panzer IV's, but they're in much smaller quantity. So don't be fooled that a lot of these German tanks are not heavy tanks that can really do tank killing. They're small things, man. And they are known as tanks, but be aware that they can't even knock out another tank. So in this battle of Dubno Brody, these Germans run into a vast number of Russian tanks. And they too have got lots of light tanks. But if you look very carefully at their light tanks can actually fight tanks. And they also have the T-34. The T-34 and some of those other Russian designs were actually designs that the Russians got from a white American tank designer called Christie. Christie actually came up with wonderful tank designs before World War II. The Russians got it from Christie, and they based their tanks on an American design by a white American guy. And the T-34 was produced in vast quantities, and it was far superior to any of the German tanks, even their heavier tanks at the time. But then, in this Battle of Dubno Brody, not only do they come across T-34s that the Germans, even the heavy German tanks, can't shoot them. Even the smaller German anti-tank guns, their shells are bouncing off these T-34s. And the bigger German armor can't shoot the T-34s. But there are tanks known as KV-1s. I think KV-1s and KV-2s. A KV-1 and a KV-2 is so thickly armored. It's got a turret that is literally just freaking inches and inches of solid freaking steel. There is no German gun that can destroy a KV-1. They can't destroy those vehicles. So these Germans are coming in with this light armor, with a bit of medium armor, and they run into vast quantities of tanks that are capable of knocking out their tanks. Their own guns can't shoot these freaking tanks. And it's not a joke. Their shells bounce off the freaking armor of these tanks. And the Russians are swarming over them with armor. But the Germans aren't crybabies, and the Germans are clever. And the German army is a clever army. And the Germans actually have lots of infantry with their tanks. So they then immediately go and they're battle hardened and they start making plans. And the way that the Germans save themselves in these situations where they run into large numbers of heavy armor that would tear their tank forces to pieces, that would just tear their tank forces to pieces and they wouldn't even be able to defend themselves. The way the Germans survive is with the Flak 88. Below in the bottom left of the picture is a Flak 88. That is a Flak 88 gun that's put on a tractor. In the early part of the war, I don't think they had many or any of these Flak 88s on these tractor type vehicles, on these half tracks. I think they pulled the Flak 88s, they towed them, and they had to put them down like an anti-tank gun, and then they would be motionless and they would then take on the Russian armor. So the way that the Germans survived was they couldn't fight the enemy tanks with their tanks. So the Germans would then use the Flak 88. The Flak 88 was originally designed as an anti-aircraft gun, a very powerful anti-aircraft gun. And then they discovered, I think it was when they fought in France, they discovered that the Flak 88s could be used against tanks. And they then could use it in various emergency situations. Another place where the German armor was totally outclassed was against the British in North Africa. And Rommel often would use his tanks, he'd go and attack the British, his tanks couldn't knock out some of the British armor, and then what he'd do is he'd retreat and lure the British back, and he'd lure them into a trap where 88s were stationary and were sitting and waiting for the British. So I think he called it the sword and shield type tactic, and he'd retreat and lure the British in so that these static guns could kill the British armor. So the thing to keep in mind about the Germans is that their tanks were not that powerful, and that the British and the Russians had such superior forces. The Russians had insanely superior forces. And yet the Germans didn't go home and cry about it. They didn't whine about it. You'll never see the Germans even complain about it. But the Germans would face these vast mechanized forces, and they would just adapt their tactics, and they'd take them on, and they'd use their intelligence, their bravery, their creativity, and they'd freaking fight these weapons that were literally impervious to their own weapons. So in this Battle of Dubno Brody, all the German anti-tank guns can't shoot the T-34s and the KV-1s, so the weapon that saves them in Dubno Brody is the Flak 88. The Flak 88 and infantry then work out tactics. And these German troops and German units, they work together and they work as a team. And they work as a team and they work out tactics and they go in and then they fight these Russians who otherwise would just swarm over them and just slaughter them. And it's very important to understand these fluid tactics of the Germans. We'll come back to things like improvisation, creativity, that even on the battlefield, when you are going into battle and you run into an enemy army and, good God, in front of you are weapons that you cannot defeat. And they're there right in front of you, and you only discover them now. And you're in the heat of battle, you're fighting for your life. And these Germans, they handle this. They don't cry, they don't run away, they just work out a plan and they carry on fighting. In that sense, the Germans are very much like the Romans. We will talk about some of those older armies as well. The German Wehrmacht and the Roman army have got a lot in common, where the troops are very solid, they're very calm, they're very intelligent, and they adapt. And they adapt, and they actually fight in situations where it looks like they can't win at all. Like the French army under Napoleon, and the Prussians under Frederick the Great, they were much more rigid in their tactics. You know, when they were ordered to do things, they had to go and do it, regardless of casualties. The Germans and the Romans are different. Germans and the Romans are much more creative, and they're creative even in the heat of battle. Even when nasty, nasty, horrible surprises come at them. So the lesson for all whites is, don't get freaked out that in the future we may have enemies who've got vast amounts of technically advanced equipment, they outnumber us, etc., etc. Take a look at what these soldiers do. Look at European military history, and you'll see that there are many, many times when armies can face situations where they should be losing, where the enemy is sitting with actual superior weaponry, and the better troops still win. They win with inferior weapons. They win through teamwork. The whole secret of the German panzers is teamwork. It's all about teamwork. Teamwork inside the tank, teamwork as a group of tanks. It's teamwork, tactics, thinking. You're looking not only at tough soldiers, brave soldiers. You're looking at intelligent soldiers who take risks and who think quickly on their feet. And if whites would just get into this way of thinking, you'll see, man, we can clean our enemies' clocks. Don't worry about numbers. Don't worry about apparent superiority of enemies. We're going to clean their clocks. But you've got to learn from these other troops who worked like this. So, the Germans should have been absolutely freaking mauled. There is another video that I did big chunks of. It was like a series about Barbarossa. I did it in 2018 and it's sitting in partially completed pieces. But in that video, which I will reassemble, I'll fix it and clean it up in over the next several months. But in that video, there we dug more into more proof that the Germans were absolutely overwhelmed. And I'm going to come back to this topic. The Germans were more overwhelmed than you can believe. That when Hitler and his troops attacked the Russians, and it wasn't a stupid thing that they were doing, they were attacking the Russians because the Russians were about 2 weeks away from attacking them. The Russians were gonna hit Germany in about 2 weeks' time, and Hitler knew it, and Hitler hit them before he was hit. He did a preemptive strike on them the way that Napoleon did a preemptive strike in the Battle of Austerlitz, in the Austerlitz campaign. The Austrians and the Russians were getting ready to invade France. Napoleon went and hit them in the kisser in Austria before they got to him. Hitler did exactly the same thing with Barbarossa. The Russians, if you listen carefully, I think if you listen very carefully to the documentary after the video, because the original video was about 27 minutes long. If you look at the documentary where you see, I think it's a Ukrainian guy who did this some years ago. If you listen carefully, he'll even tell you that the Russians didn't have maps of Russia. The Russian forces were sitting with maps of Germany. Because they were all going to go to clobber Germany. And the Germans came and clobbered them. And they were actually sitting without maps of their own roads at the time that they were fighting the Germans in their own territory. But I will let you in on something, that the Russians had so much weaponry, the Russians probably had more tanks than all of the nations of Europe combined. I'm going to repeat that. The Russians, at the time that Hitler smacked them, probably had more tanks than all the nations of Europe. I'm talking Italy, France, Germany, Poland, you name it, okay? The Russians had more tanks than everybody else put together, including the Germans. At the start of Barbarossa, the Russians very possibly had more than five times as many tanks as the entire Wehrmacht. They probably had more than five times as many tanks as Hitler invaded them with. They had vast stockpiles of weapons, and they had far superior weapons. And how was all their superior weaponry created? Jews and American capitalists built enormous factories in the Jewish Bolshevik Soviet Union in the 1920s. They built enormous factories in the Soviet Union, Jewish Communist Soviet Union. So when the Germans were facing the Soviets, the Jews had pumped them up with weapons, with armor, with money, with factories. They could churn out vast quantities of tanks at a pace that far exceeded anything the Germans were ever able to match. The Germans were fighting an enemy where the enemy had factories that were just pouring out thousands of tanks when the Germans were only capable of producing a few hundred. In aircraft, they were given aircraft in vast quantities. They were given more aircraft than the entire size of the Luftwaffe. These are numbers I'll go into when I bring out my Barbarossa stuff, but that's for much later in the year. But I just want to tell you, you have no idea what these Germans faced at the opening of Barbarossa. Yet this German army walked in there, and these infantry, backed with their panzers, they fought the most insane armies that were going to just crush the life out of Germany, and they just tore them to pieces. They ripped them to shit. They captured hundreds of thousands of troops at a time. They won the greatest battles in the history of the world. And then you hear all these scumbags who say, oh, you know, Hitler didn't make it to Moscow in December because Hitler's a damn idiot. Ah, go away, you stupid fool. You have no idea what these people went through and the battles they fought and the things they achieved and the problems they overcame. Hitler in one place even said, I think Leon de Grel quoted Hitler like this, Hitler said that when he invaded Russia, he was like a man standing at a door, and he doesn't know what's behind that door. And he kicks that door open, and he goes in. He doesn't fully know what's there, but he's got to do what he's got to do. And if Hitler had not engaged in that preemptive strike against the Soviet Union, the Germans would have lost the war, definitely. The Germans would never have won the war because the Soviets were going to attack them anyway. So all these crybabies and fools who comment about Hitler's moves in World War II, the one talks more shit than the other. Really, they talk a lot of junk. And as time goes by, I'll see what I can show you. And you'll see the numbers and you'll see everything. See, these people are talking a bunch of shit about the Wehrmacht and the Luftwaffe and everything. The greatest, most successful battles that have ever taken place in the history of our race took place in the Soviet Union, and Operation Barbarossa, those first few months, were the greatest, most amazing victories that have ever been fought by any whites who ever lived. So here's my original video. It's 27 minutes long. And another one will come after it, which also talks about Dubno Brody with more details. And my commentary will come right at the end. Enjoy. Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies told by the liberals, the Jews, the commies, all of those with an anti-white agenda. Because they have a media and publishing monopoly, they can push any line that they want. White people, being reliant on these things and having let these institutions fall into the hands of these Jews and other anti-whites, look to them for information without realizing how much censorship is taking place. And it's not just the mass media that's in the hands of the Jews. It's also the publishing that's in the hands of the Jews. There are entire books that have just disappeared and have never been translated into English because it did not suit the Jewish agenda. An example of that is Alexander Solzhenitsyn's book, 200 Years Together, about the Jews in Russia. That book at the moment is being translated privately by some people, and the only magazine that I know of that's ever done any kind of write-up about it is the Barnes Review,
which is an excellent magazine, I might add. So let's take a look at something else relating to World War II. If you ask any student of World War II, what was the greatest tank battle of World War II, he will tell you it's the Battle of Kursk. And as with Stalingrad, the liberals and the Jews like to fawn about, oh, you know, it was the beginning of the end of German power. The supermen weren't supermen. They were defeated by the blacks, the Mongols, anybody who is non-white. Oh, they love that kind of theme. They love it. But what happens when the supermen were really supermen and they really did whack somebody? Well, apparently it turns out you just freaking write it out of history. I want to just spend a few minutes just putting World War II in perspective. I never realized to what extent World War II was really about a war between Russia and Germany. In fact, the only time it really hit me, about 20 years ago, I was into board war gaming, and I used to enjoy buying board war games and playing them. And I loved the ones that were all very historically accurate. And there was a board war game called The Rise and Decline of the Third Reich. When I played this game, I was absolutely astounded by the scale of the war between Germany and Russia. As I played this war game, it became apparent that at least 75% of the war in Europe was nothing but the war between Germany and Russia. Of course, if you listen to the British, the British will go on about how clever they were and how they outwitted the Germans and how they were spying on them and breaking their codes and all the British exploits. They'll even take something that was a flop, like the Dam Busters raid, and they'll write it up as if it was a great victory. The Dam Busters raid was a flop, but they'll write it up as if it was a huge victory. In fact, the British contribution to World War II is almost something akin to that of a third world nation. You may think that I'm joking about this. If you go and you look at the British contribution to World War II on land, at sea it's different, but on land, it amounted to almost nothing. There were several countries in Europe, and I'm talking small countries in Europe, who had bigger armies and better combat results than the British. The British were nothing more than a mosquito trying to irritate the Germans. The British were almost nothing. So the British had to rely on the entire British Empire. They needed people from South Africa, Australia, New Zealand. They even had to call in the Americans in order to amount to something. But the real war on land was between Germany and Russia. In fact, in the video that I'm going to show you, which is part of a bigger talk, it's given at the U.S. Army War College. In this talk by a colonel, he tells you a lot about World War II, and he's spent his lifetime studying the war between the Russians and the Germans. But I'm going to give you just a small excerpt of this so that you can just get a feel for it, because he's very technical. But there are maybe serious students among you who would like to watch the full video, and I'll give you the details of what it's called at the end. So let's return to the biggest tank battle of World War II. The biggest tank battle of World War II, in every reference book you'll find, is the Battle of Kursk. And the Battle of Kursk took place in July to August 1943. But Kursk was a huge effort that involved several armies, and it wasn't a single battle. So if you go to Wikipedia and look up Kursk, you'll see all sorts of impressive statistics. They will tell you that all of this is just a huge campaign, and it's not a particular battle. It's actually one particular battle in that campaign that is the one that they call the biggest tank battle of World War II. So you'd have to hunt around a bit on Wikipedia, and then you'll discover that the biggest tank battle inside this Battle of Kursk. So then I'll tell you that the biggest tank battle is actually a single battle that occurred in this Kursk offensive. And that battle is called the Battle of Prokhorovka, and it took place on the 11th of July. Now, if we go on Wikipedia and we read about it, we read the following. I'm not going to concern myself with all the other details about it. I'm just going to get to the numbers because we're interested in the numbers because that defines which is the biggest tank battle of World War II. So here at the end of the section on the Battle of Prokhorovka, here it says, the battle is considered a tactical defeat for the Red Army due to the heavy tank losses, but operationally was a draw or a Soviet victory. Neither the 5th Guards Tank Army nor the 2nd SS Panzer Corps accomplished their objectives, though the Soviet counterattack failed and they were thrown back onto the defensive. They did enough to stop a German breakthrough. Tank losses during the battle have been a contentious subject. Let me just pause for a second. You will find that communists are terrible liars when it comes to battle casualties. They vastly exaggerate their enemy's losses and they massively downplay their own losses. And here in Africa, I'll tell you, the blacks did exactly the same. Massively overstated anything that could be thought of as a minor victory, and they downplay what you really achieve. But when you get into the facts and into the raw data, you'll see what really happened. So let's return to this. Soviet tank losses have been estimated from 200 to 822, but Soviet records show about 300 complete losses and as many damaged. The Soviets claimed, here we go, enormous German losses, stating that they had destroyed at least 400 tanks, including 100 Tiger tanks, and inflicting 3,500 deaths. German records indicate 3 to 5 of their own tanks destroyed and between 40 and 70 damaged. Their manpower losses are estimated at 500 killed. So there you see an enormous discrepancy between what the Russians say happened and what the Germans say happened. Now, this is according to Wikipedia. Then I went to another website, which is called militaryeducation.org. And it's got a section called 10 Most Epic Tank Battles in Military History. If you go and look at it, you'll see a couple of tank battles, including a very interesting one listed as number 8 called the Battle of Rasenai. For the 23rd to the 27th of June 1941. It's a tank battle you've not heard of. I'm mentioning it because it's a surprisingly large battle, and you'll see it was Germans versus Russians. Now, if you carry on down through the military education article, you will come to tank battle number 1. And tank battle number 1, the greatest tank battle in history, is called the Battle of Prokhorovka. And they say, part of Battle of Kursk, 12 July 1943. So here is what militaryeducation.org has to say about it. It says, known as the largest tank battle in military history, the Battle of Prokhorovka saw 800 to 850 tanks of the Soviet Army line up against the significantly smaller force of the Germans. Russian sources put the German number of tanks between 500 and 700. Although figures from German sources are not available, the real number is likely to have been far less, with 294 German tanks having been listed as available the day before the battle. So what they're saying is that it was probably 800 to 850 Russian tanks versus about just under 300 German tanks. After fierce and intense fighting resulting in many dead and wounded, the outcome of the battle was not immediately clear. The Russians claimed a propaganda victory, partly due to the fact that Hitler had been forced to call off the attack on the Kursk salient. Clearly, the Soviets were far from finished as a force in the war, and the tide was beginning to turn away from the Germans. So that is pretty much what they will tell you is the largest tank battle in history. And every single reference work you come across will say this to you. But the other day I ran into a video, and it came from the U.S. Army War College. And it was a lecture given by an American, I think he was a colonel, who spent most of his life studying The War on the Eastern Front, The War Between Germany and Russia. He's written several books, and he has a talk that takes 7 hours long, a talk which he says he's never been able to finish because it is so long. Anyway, somebody managed to get some film footage of him giving the same talk, but crammed into a one-hour session. And the talk that he gives is called The Soviet-German War, 1941-45, Myths and Realities. Now, while he was giving this talk, I was very interested in this because a little while back, I did a video called The Battle of Stalingrad. And I was discussing the lies told about the Battle of Stalingrad. But I was merely talking from my little bit of knowledge that I had of what the Germans had written about Stalingrad. So I was very interested when I came across this particular talk by this army colonel, because I'd suspected that there were a lot of myths and lies about this war on the Eastern Front. In fact, this colonel tells you that 9 out of 10 German veterans who are alive today fought the Russians and never once fought any of the Allies, that is, any American or British troops. He said you will be hard-pressed to find any German soldier who actually fought against the Allies. They were fighting on the Eastern Front. And the Eastern Front is the biggest war in the history of mankind. There is no war that comes even close to that war. While I was listening to this talk, he did mention the myths about Stalingrad. But then it turned out that there were lots of myths, enormous numbers of myths, about all parts of the war. But the most interesting myths were all about the beginning of the war. It turns out that when the Germans invaded, you won't hear too much detail about the first part of Operation Barbarossa when the Germans invaded Russia. They'll just tell you the Russian armies collapsed and blah, 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 and the Germans just kind of waltzed in. Turns out that whole thing is a big lie, entirely. And this colonel will tell you what really went on during Barbarossa. Interestingly enough, he talks about certain battles and certain information that has not been available for 50 years. This reminds me of a book that I bought a couple of years ago. The book that really got me interested in Adolf Hitler and the Nazis was a book published in England, and it was called The Birth of the Nazis. It was published in 2006. And what astounded me was when I saw on the cover, it said that here was information that had not been seen in print in English in 50 years. It spoke about another part of the war inside Germany. This is before Hitler arose. There was a civil war in Germany. And a whole bunch of information about that also just happened not to make it to the ears of English-speaking people. In fact, this is what you will discover. You will find that we've been lied to by omission on a bigger scale than you can imagine. So anyway, let's return now to this tank battle story. The colonel's talking, and while he's talking about Barbarossa, he starts telling you about the myths that he came across and entire battles that were written out of history. In fact, there's another one. He tells you about an instance where the Germans wiped out 500,000 Russians. It was such an embarrassment that all of that has been edited out of history. They completely have removed it. In fact, later on in his talk, he tells you other enormous lies that they tell you even about the final stages of the war, where the Germans were still putting up a very spirited resistance, and the Germans were still smashing and defeating Soviet attacks towards the end of the war. The Soviets then decided, the Russians decided to rather just pretend all of this never happened. If you have the time and the interest, it's well worth spending an hour watching that video. You will be astounded at the things he's going to tell you. But the one that really hit me between the eyes was when he spoke about the greatest tank battle of World War II. He happens to mention in a minute of duration, on the 28th of June 1941, an enormous tank battle took place where the Russians sent 5,000 tanks to attack the Germans. Many of the tanks broke down and only 3,000 actually reached the battlefield. When they got to the battlefield, the Germans smashed them. The Germans wiped out all 3,000 of their tanks for the loss of 300 to 350 German tanks. Yes, you heard the right thing there. The Germans wiped out 3,000 tanks for the loss of 300 to 350. But you see, the problem with that is that we would have to say that the greatest tank battle of World War II was won by the Germans. And of course, we can't have these Aryan supermen. You know, we can't tell everybody that these Aryan supermen were indeed Aryan supermen. So we have to write that out of history and pretend that a bunch of blacks and Mongols and everybody else was better than the German soldier. But in fact, the Germans were absolutely first class. They were astounding. So I'm going to show you some parts of this talk just so that you get a bit of a feel. It's not very long. It does sound technical, but just bear with it. I will draw your attention to the very relevant parts, and I hope that it opens your eyes and that you start looking around more closely. Just remember, the Jews lie a lot by omission. In fact, I will repeat yet again that most people outside of Germany know nothing about Germany. Much of what we know about Germany is a very narrow portion of German history. There is a lot about Germany that is very relevant. It's extremely relevant. But the Jews just decided not to tell you. For example, the question, where did Hitler come from? You don't really know the answer. I assure you, you don't know the answer. You need to go and study the part of German history that the Jews elected to omit from the English-speaking world's attention. And in order to truly understand the Germans and Hitler, you need to know about the civil war that occurred inside Germany at the end of World War I. Aha, you might say a civil war. Indeed, there was a civil war, a communist civil war with Jews and communists, and it was a very bloody affair. But you just never got to hear about that. That's just one of many things that you didn't get to hear about. I also just want to say to the regular listeners of this channel, I know many of you are not keen on listening to Nazis and listening about Hitler. I want to ask you, please, please, give me a chance to tell you a little bit about them. I also was like you, and I also did not want to spend my time studying Hitler because he was so evil, and the Nazis because they were so bad. You will discover to your amazement that these were normal white people, good white people, the best white people you can imagine. In the future, when I put up some videos about Nazis, about Hitler, about racists, please just hang in there and just listen to what I have to tell you, because there is a great deal that you haven't been told. And remember, especially for the white American audience, remember that you people are now the ones being lied about right in your faces. They're lying about you now because it's your turn. But they lied about everybody else before they focused on you. So sit back and listen to those of us who were lied about. There are things we can tell you that, as usual, the Jews forgot to tell you. So listen to this excerpt about the greatest tank battle of World War II, which nobody would like you to know about. Enjoy.
Framework, beginning with the Barbarossa campaign of the summer of 41, to talk about those portions of the historical record that are flagrantly missing. Now, beginning of each of these campaigns, I'll throw up a slide that's got a lot of numbers on it. Basically, I prepared this slide because it gives you some idea of the relative scale and scope of what's going on in the West as opposed to what's going on in the East. And very frankly, at least until the summer of 44, what's going on in the West pales by comparison to what's going on in the East by almost every indices. June 41, U.S. Congress at peace. In October, the Congress renewed the draft, as you recall, by one vote. The U.S. Army strength, 1.5 million men. The same month, June, Hitler's Wehrmacht invades the Soviet Union with a force of over 3 million men, crushed Red Army forces in the border region, and shattered the Red Army, advancing on Leningrad, Moscow, and Rostov. The 5 million men Red Army lost 2.8 million by 1 October, 1.6 million more by 31 December. During this period, they raised 821 division equivalents, 483 rifles, 73 tanks, 31 mechanized, and so on down the line, and lost a total of 229 division equivalents. That's like losing the entire United States Army today 30 times over. In October 41, Stalin evacuated the bulk of the Soviet government to Kuibyshev. The Wehrmacht began its final advance on Moscow in November. Now, U.S. lend-lease aid, November 41, extended to the Soviet Union and the Battle of Britain and the British offensive in North Africa. I'm not going to dwell on these slides very long because we don't really have time to do it, but if you take a glance at them, you'll see, at least in terms of the numbers, the disparity between scope and scale in the two major theaters of war. Now, this map kind of captures in gross form the nature, the course and nature of the summer fall campaign of June to December 1941. This is the campaign of Barbarossa, generally characterized as a massive and seamless German advance beginning on 22 June 41 and terminating on the 4th of December 1941, which initially encircles many Soviet armies in the border districts, five more here at Kiev, and ends up with German forces at the gates of Moscow by early December. And yet, if you take a careful look now, based on the new sources, at the course of this campaign, it was by no means as easy as previous books have described. In fact, throughout the entire campaign, the Red Army attempted on several occasions to mount strategic counteroffensives. Much less counterstrokes of operational scale and numerous counterattacks, often producing bloody fighting on both sides. For example, on the 28th of June 1941, as Army Group South, with its first Panzer Group, was advancing eastward toward Kiev, Zhukov himself, Chief of Staff of the Soviet Army, came to the front and implemented a major counteroffensive using six of the Southwestern Front's mechanized corps. This, in fact, is the biggest tank battle in World War II, and scarcely a word has been written on it. 5,000 Soviet tanks, 3,000 of which make it to the battlefield, most of which are destroyed, roughly 350 German tanks in this fight in the Dubno and Brody area. Or often Lithuania and Latvia, and later the approaches to Leningrad, where the Soviets launched two major multi-army counterstrokes, one near Rasenai and one up near Staraya Russa, both of which delayed the German advance on Leningrad, each of the counterstrokes roughly a week to a week and a half, ultimately throwing the German timetable off in the advance on Leningrad, costing the 8th Panzer Division at one point, after it was encircled, most of its armored strength, and ripping it out of Army Group's order of battle for the next 5 months. It wouldn't participate in the battle for Leningrad, and that's one of the reasons Leningrad didn't fall. Or in late August 41, a massive Soviet offensive by the Reserve, Western, and Bryansk fronts against German Army Group Center east of Smolensk, a huge offensive. right into the teeth of Guderian's Panzer forces as they advanced south towards Kiev. This offensive, not a word has been written about in the past 50 years. It cost the Red Army almost 500,000 casualties, and when the Germans resumed their drive on Moscow on 30 September 1941, that's why they make the initial progress they do. So there are a host of forgotten battles in the 41 Barbarossa campaign. This is a chart that we if we'd had time to study it, and that's what you really have to do with it, shows you the forgotten battles on the right and the known ones on the left. But the main part of the chart are these myths that have grown out of the war. The myth of Stalin. Much less counterstrokes of operational scale and numerous counterattacks, often producing bloody fighting on both sides. For example, on the 28th of June 1941, as Army Group South, with its first Panzer Group, was advancing eastward toward Kiev, Zhukov himself, Chief of Staff of the Soviet Army, came to the front and implemented a major counteroffensive using six of the Southwestern Front's mechanized corps. This, in fact, is the biggest tank battle in World War II, and scarcely a word has been written on it. 5,000 Soviet tanks, 3,000 of which make it to the battlefield, most of which are destroyed, roughly 300, 350 German tanks in this fight in the Dubno and Brody area.
Тут, в полях на південному заході історичної Волині.
Here in the fields of the southwest of historical Volyn, in the first days of the German-Soviet war during World War II, a significant military troops clash took place between the former allies. The tank battle in the triangle of Lutsk-Dubno-Brody lasted 8 days from June 23rd to June 30th and became the largest and most numerous tank battle in world history. The battle itself and the number of tanks that took part in it are controversial. Soviet and Russian historians and sources traditionally hide the mistakes of the USSR and significantly understate the number of equipment in order to bring to a focus the smaller Porkerivka battle in 1943 in the first place, where they suffered a significant defeat despite 2 to 3 times advantage. Let's try to understand what happened at the end of June 1941 in western Ukraine. Let's start with the fact that the German Third Reich attacked its ally, mentor, and comrade-in-arms in the outbreak of World War II, the Soviet Union, in June 1941. It can be assumed that it was a preventative strike according to the plan of the Fast War Blitzkrieg, better known as Operation Barbarossa, Redbeard, named after the German national hero Frederick Barbarossa, the first emperor of the Holy Roman Empire in the 12th century. One of the main goals of the Reich was to quickly remove from the game its dangerous ally in the rear, capture Ukraine for provisions and the oil basins of the Caucasus to continue the conquests. It is said that from the very beginning of the war with Germany, the Soviet Union had the best, strongest, and most powerful tanks that could exist in the world at that time. And it's true. In the late 1930s, the USSR had such machines as T-34, KV-1, KV-2, T-35. These were huge monsters weighing up to 52 tons and with maintenance staff from 4 to 11 people. Many of them were built in Ukraine, in particular Kharkiv, according to drawings and under the guidance of Western engineers. Communists in the 30s bought drawings of the leading American tank engineer, Walter Christie. The payment for these tanks was largely the assets from the sale of Ukrainian grain in the 30s and the sale of confiscated and looted jewelry and gold in Ukraine during the two previous decades of occupation. These Soviet tanks were so strong that the Germans remembered how their shells bounced off the armor without causing significant damage. Our 3.7-centimeter anti-tank gun waits patiently while the tanks come within a suitable firing range. Then, however, we couldn't believe our eyes. Our anti-tank shells were just bouncing off the tanks. The enemy tanks kept advancing towards us without stopping and were firing at us with all their weapons. Then something unexpected happened. After recovering from the fright of seeing these steel giants, our infantry began to attack, throwing hand grenades at the tanks. 1st Mountain Division, Edelweiss. In total, the USSR on June 22, 1941, had more than 24,000 tanks. The majority were light BT and T-26. The remaining 1,400 were medium and heavy tanks. On the other hand, the Germans had 6,052 tanks. There were 3,903 of them on the Eastern Front. On the Eastern Front, the USSR had 2.7 million infantry and the Reich almost 4 million. The lack of tanks was fully compensated by an advantage in infantry and tactics. In addition, the Germans actively used aircraft for intelligence and tank destruction. This is what the Soviet troops lacked. Directly in the battle near Lutsk-Dubno-Brody, the Third Reich forces had 728 panzers in four mechanized divisions, organized in two mechanized corps. About 460 were new medium tanks, Panzer III and Panzer IV, 150 with 20mm guns unsuitable for combat against tanks, and 115 commander's tanks without weapons at all. The tanks were organized into the 1st Panzer Group, commanded by General Oberst Ewald von Kleist. That was the weakest panzer group out of the four that attacked the USSR. On the other hand, on the same section of the front, under the command of Colonel General Mikhailo Kirpanos, USSR had, according to various sources, from 4,606 to 5,826 tanks, tankettes, and self-propelled guns. They were organized into 11 mechanized divisions in five mechanized corps, 8th, 9th, 15th, 19th, 22nd. 702 were heavy and medium tanks, almost equal to the number of German panzers. About 3,800 Soviet tanks out of all available took part in the Battle of the Lutsk-Dubno-Brody Triangle. For comparison, in the Battle of Kursk, which lasted more than 1.5 months, a total number of tanks was 6,143. In the battle alone near Porkhorivka, there were 1,156 units. The German tank forces consisted of four mechanized divisions in two mechanized corps. Those were the 13th, 14th, 11th, and 16th Panzer Divisions. The total number of tanks that took part in the battle was 4,528 units. Let's take a look at the main tanks that took part in the battle between Lutsk-Dubno-Brody. The Third Reich had Panzer I, which was produced from 1933 onward, 13mm armor, 5.4 tons weight, 2 MG machine guns, 57 horsepower gasoline engines, 37 kilometer speed, 2 people crew. Panzer II was larger. It was produced from 1935 onward. Armor was 5 to 15 millimeter, 8.9 tons weight, 20 millimeter gun, and MG-34 machine gun, Maybach 140 horsepower gasoline engine, 40 kilometer speed, 3 people crew. Panzer III was the newest. It was produced from 1938 onward. Armor 15 to 30 millimeter, 19.5 to 23 tons weight. One of the guns from 37 to 50 millimeter, 2 to 3 MG-34 machine guns, 300 horsepower engine, 20 to 40 kilometer per hour speed, 5 people crew. Panzer IV is the largest German tank of the time. It was produced from 1936. armor was 20 to 30 millimeter from 50 to 80 millimeter, 18.4 to 25 tons weight, 75 millimeter gun, two MG-34 machine guns, Maybach 300 horsepower gasoline engine, 31 to 42 kilometer speed, 5 people crew. The USSR was armed with BT tank and its modifications, produced from 1931 on the basis of drawings of American tank engineer Walter Christie. Armor was up to 6 to 23 millimeter, 11.5 to 13.9 tons of weight, 45 millimeter cannon, 1 to 3 Degtyaryov machine guns, 4 to 500 horsepower gasoline engine, up to 72 kilometer per hour speed, 3 people crew. T-26 tanks were the most numerous in the Battle of Dubno. It was produced from 1931 onward. Armor was 6 to 15 millimeter, 9.6 tons weight, 45 millimeter cannon, DT machine gun, 90 horsepower gasoline engine, 16 to 31 kilometer an hour speed, 3 people crew. The T-34 was also based on Christie's drawings. It was produced from 1940. 13 to 45 millimeter armor, 26 tons weight, 76.2 millimeter cannon, two DT machine guns, 500 horsepower diesel engine, 25 to 53 kilometers an hour speed, and 4 people crew. KV-1, Climate Voroshilov, a heavy tank, was produced from 1939. Armor was 20 to 90 millimeters, 43 to 45 tons of weight, 76.2 millimeter cannon, 3 DT machine guns, 500 horsepower diesel engine, 34 kilometer an hour speed, 5 people crew. T-35 heavy tank was produced from 1932 onward. Armor was 10 to 50 millimeters, 45 to 50 tons weight, armed with 76.2 millimeter and two 45 millimeter cannons, several DT machine guns, 500 horsepower gasoline engine, 29 kilometer an hour speed, 11 people crew. KV-2 was the heaviest tank on the battlefield. It was produced from 1940, 30 to 75 millimeter armor, 52 tons weight, 152 millimeter howitzer, 3 DT machine guns, 600 horsepower diesel engine, 34 kilometers an hour speed, 6 people crew. The Third Reich had three main directions of strikes on chosen Panzerstrasse tank roads. Northern road through Volodymyr and Lutsk. Central road through Radikiv, Dubno, and Ostro. Southern road through Kamianka, Buzka, and Ternopil. In the northern direction, one of the first tank clashes was near the village of Vinnytsia, between Volodymyr and Lutsk on June 24th. The German 14th Division met the resistance of 300 light T-26s of the 22nd Mechanized Corps. Later, few T-34s drove up. They were easily suppressed and moved to Lutsk. Although in the early days of the battle, the Soviet troops had some victories. On the same day, the German 13th Panzer Division encountered Soviet artillery on the northern road to Lutsk near Torchin and lost about 40% of its vehicles in just one day. This is not because they were knocked out by Soviet tanks, but by anti-tank formations. But the main events took place in the central direction of Dubno-Ostro. The first battle took place near Radikiv on June 23, 1941. Before the battle, the Germans did not even know about the presence of the newest and most powerful Soviet T-34 and KV tanks. In the first days of the battle, the meeting with them caused fear, but in practice it became clear how to destroy them.
Feindliche Stoßtrupp ist zusammengeschossen. Unmittelbar vor unseren Stellungen liegen Dutzende von vernichteten Sowjetpanzern. Sie wurden zumeist von unseren Grenadieren in kühnen Einzelgängen erledigt.
The picture of the battle in general was next. German forces quickly wedged a narrow blade between the Soviet troops. The Soviets attacked from the south and north, less from the east. This may indicate that they were mostly late in reacting to the rapid attack of the Germans, who had time to prepare and repel Soviet counterattacks. On June 26, the Soviet command attempted a counterattack with the possibility of thrust to Vinnytsia. For this purpose, 3 Mech Corps were sent to the battle. There were 8th, 9th, 19th Corps. Apparently, they thought that this would be enough to stop a small tank force of the enemy. The main counterattack from the south of Brody was carried out by the strongest 8th Mech Corps in order to hit the opponent on the right flank. For that, the Corps made a 500-kilometer march. The machines at that time were not designed for such big distances in a short time, so many of them needed repair before the battle. Thanks to German air and radio intelligence, the command learned about this plan, and they prepared troops for an encounter of Soviet formations. Soviet tanks managed to wedge themselves into the defense of the 16th Division and even approached Berestechko, where all the Panzers Command was located, and went to the rear of the 11th Panzer Division. At this time, on June 27th, a strong Soviet 15th Mechanized Corps approached the Germans from the Lviv side. It seemed that the Nazis were about to be crushed. But the 8th Corps suffered heavy losses from German aircraft and infantry divisions. The Soviet 37th Infantry Corps did not go to support tanks during these days, but simply stood and waited in the rear. And Rescue 15th Mech Corps was receiving commands from various leaders and traveled ineffectively from village to village until it went north in the direction of Volodymyr. They didn't even know where the 8th Corps was fighting. The Soviet command gave the order to stop the tank attack of the 8th Corps to move the counterattack in another direction. But some of the tanks by that time had already retreated back to Brody. There they turned to the east, and part of the 8th Corps went to Dubno under the command of Mykola Popel. The rest were left to fight the 16th Panzer Division. On June 27, thanks to this maneuver through the Verba village, the Soviets marched on the outskirts of Dubno and cut off and surrounded Hans Gube's 11th Panzer Division, which was advancing to Ostrog and at that time was fighting the 19th Mechanized Corps. This was the greatest and the last success of Soviet troops in this battle. Popel did not occupy Dubno because of German infantry and artillery there. On June 28th, near Lutsk, the 9th Corps, under Rokossovsky command, under pressure from the 13th and 14th Panzer Divisions, despite orders to counterattack, turned around and fled to the borderline of 1939. On the same day, June 28th, part of Popel's 8th Corps, unexpectedly for the Germans, stopped attacking the 11th Panzer Division from the rear and stopped in front of Dubno to wait for another part of its corps. Meanwhile, near the Verba village south of Dubno was a tank battle where the 16th Panzer Division struck General Popel's group in the rear. At the same time, the entire 8th Popel's Corps was surrounded by German infantry divisions. Additional German infantry entered Dubno. By the end of the day, any chance of the Soviets to win the battle was completely lost. The 8th Corps waited for reinforcements in the encirclement for another 2 days until July 1st. On June 30th, the remnants of Soviet troops were ordered to retreat to the border of 1939 to the defense of Stalingrad. The losses of the USSR in the Battle of Lutsk-Dubno-Brody were enormous. Its troops in western Ukraine were almost completely defeated. 2,648 tanks were lost. During 15 days of fighting in this region, 4,381 tanks were in loss already. The Red Army, under pressure and due to the lack of auxiliary vehicles and equipment, retreated and threw almost all the armored vehicles. The Germans then repaired it and used it at the front. This opened for the Third Reich the way to Kyiv, where a week later, on July 7th, the battle for Kyiv began. The losses of the panzers were not so significant. It was about 260 units. Most of them were repaired and participated in the next battle. How did the Germans manage to defeat the overwhelming Soviet tank forces? Soviet heavy and light tanks did not have radios to communicate with the headquarters and their commanders directly, and with the crews of other tanks. The radio was only in the commander's tank. He was ordered either by agreement with the other commanders to change direction or gave signals with the flags. Then dozens of his subordinate vehicles saw that and followed him. But these tanks often lost sight of the commander's tank, or it was knocked out after the chaos began. Tanks were getting lost, driving across fields, or falling into the swamp and drainage canals, coming across each other even before reaching the Germans. And when they arrived, they became an easy target. Many tanks also lacked internal communication in the tank itself. The tank crewmen wore only ordinary helmets without headphones or laryngophones. Communication inside the tanks was as follows. The commander was in the tower, at the height, and the tank driver below. In order not to shout, it was very hard to hear something while the engine was running and during the battle. The commander pushed the driver in different parts of the body. If it was necessary to turn right, he pushed the driver in the right shoulder. If to turn left, the left shoulder. If it was necessary to go straight, he pushed on the head or neck. To stop, he pushed in the back. Unlike Soviet, all Reich tanks had radios and intercommunication. That's why they were able to move to the right places and respond quickly to changes in tactical situations on the battlefield. Although they did not have such powerful armor and weapons, they had greater mobility, maneuverability, and coherence, which allowed them to approach at close range and shoot tanks of the former Soviet Union close to the side and rear, where there was weak armor, fuel tanks, and engine. In addition, the Germans had strong technical support. Each division had about 2,000 escort trucks to support every 100 to 200 tanks. There was almost no support for Soviet tanks because no one hoped for a sudden attack. The communists were too confident in the strength of the army and thought that the information about the preparation of the Nazis for the attack was propaganda and provocation of the West. The USSR, on the other hand, was preparing to attack the German Reich. But the Germans attacked earlier, and in the midst of a large-scale Soviet mobilization and preparations to war. The attack against the Reich was planned for July 1941, with the main attack to Lublin. This was confirmed by the orders of the Soviet command on the evening of June 22nd to go to Lublin. Local commanders had only maps of European roads west of the Western Bug River. Almost all Soviet soldiers were recruits mobilized in 1940, in the spring of 1941. The mechanized divisions were formed only in September 1940. Many tank crewmen had only 2 to 5 hours of tank driving experience. Most officers were also inexperienced, as they replaced combat officers killed in the 1937 and 1938 by Stalin's regime. Soviet mechanized infantry divisions were such only on paper. They had almost no vehicles and fought on foot like ordinary infantry. In the first weeks, hundreds of thousands of Red Army soldiers quit and fled home or capitulated. They left military equipment and weapons in the fields. The Germans didn't even know what to do with so many prisoners. There was almost no supply of fuel and spare parts, and the tanks were simply breaking down on the move, so the soldiers were burning or damaging them. This equipment became German trophies and was later used again. One of the Soviet officers mentioned that in search of fuel, he sent soldiers to a distance of more than 100 to 150 kilometers from their location. Due to the disagreement between the commanders and the teams, as well as the lack of intelligence, entire columns of tanks, and sometimes divisions, traveled in vain in the fields for hundreds of kilometers looking for German troops. So they were running out of fuel, they were breaking, stuck in the swamp, drowning in the rivers and ponds. The Soviet infantry was hardly involved in tank battles. It lacked anti-tank weapons and coordination. Their attacks were not coordinated, therefore, with the help of artillery and anti-tank crews, a large number of tanks were destroyed. 97th Wehrmacht Light Infantry Division. On the other hand, the Germans did not use panzers to fight other tanks. Their tactic was to lure enemy tanks to their artillery positions. At that time, 37mm and 50mm guns disabled light tanks, and 88mm flak anti-aircraft guns were engaged in heavy ones, knocking them out at a distance of 1 kilometer. One such anti-aircraft gun could fire out 20 to 30 tanks in an hour. The 11th Panzer Division included the elite German Garing Regiment of the Luftwaffe, and its anti-aircraft guns knocked out a lot of the newest Soviet tanks near Dubno. In addition, automatic 20mm anti-aircraft guns were successfully used. The Germans placed them on vehicles. In German documents dated 1941, it's mentioned that the largest Soviet tanks, KV-1 and 2, could be knocked out even with a 50mm gun on board at a distance of up to 400 meters. Some very fast, heavy enemy tanks appeared with 76.2mm armament, T-34, that are capable of firing very accurately over a long range. Our tanks clearly concede to them. These 37mm anti-tank armament is hopeless against them. They can only be hit at close range with an 88mm anti-aircraft gun at higher than average range, from the Combat Journal of the 48 Corps. And these are not all their secrets. During the offensive, in addition to tanks, the Germans actively used mechanized infantry, which with anti-tank guns, light guns, and grenades destroyed most Soviet tanks. Thanks to the infantry, the Germans were able to defeat the huge Soviet tank armada. The Soviets had a disorganization between the commanders and the soldiers. Georgi Zhukov, the command staff commander, said, "Attack now, because it will be too late." Mikhailo Kriponos, the commander of the front, in his turn said to wait with the attack for another 2 days to prepare and gather armored forces. Soviet troops were given various mutually exclusive orders from different commanders. The strongest 8th Mech Corps were given orders from three headquarters at the same time. Tank forces were pushed in battle by parts. As soon as they prepared a few tanks, they threw at the Germans. In this way, they could be gradually destroyed. Each German tank was equipped with a radio station, and all their actions were coordinated from the command post or the commander's tank on the battlefield. This allowed the application of new tactics. They could concentrate their fire on one tank, then switch to another until they destroyed the entire enemy group of tanks. Another weakness of the Soviet tank armament was the small number of armor-piercing shells, and because of their impractical design, they pierced the panzers only from a close distance. The artillery used old 76mm guns of the 1902 model with obsolete shells that hardly damaged German tanks. The Germans noted the extreme fanaticism of the Red Army soldiers during this battle. What we did not anticipate in this battle was the fanatical fighting spirit of the tank crews. Despite our obvious advantage in terms of strength of numbers and in anti-tank weapons, the enemy light tanks continued to attack, despite their losses. Even when they were in a hopeless situation, with their engines smashed and their Caterpillar tracks ripped, or would start fighting afresh once our tanks had passed them. From the Combat Journal of the 48 Corps. The battle near Lutsk-Dubno-Brody was not only a tank battle. This is no longer the First World War, where tanks could significantly influence the course of the war. The Germans, in contrast to Soviet troops, used tanks to break through the enemy's line, its encirclement. These breakthroughs were filled by infantry and other formations. The Soviet leadership relied only on the strength and power of tank formations without the use of other types of troops, which was one of the main reasons for the defeat in the early days of the German-Soviet War. 370 kilometers from Dubno to Kyiv, German troops passed in a week with almost no resistance. Even the Stalin line of reinforced concrete bunkers in the Polesia region could not delay them for long. From Ukraine's point of view, everything looked as if the two occupiers had once again come together to fight for possession of its strategic position, lands, resources, and people. In the same fields in June and July near Berestechko, there was a battle between the Cossacks and Tatars against Polish troops in 1651. The Battle of Lutsk, or Brusilov Offensive in the First World War between the Russian Empire, Austria-Hungary, and Germany. The very location of convenient flat ground roads right in the center between the Black and Baltic Seas becomes a corridor for various troops and sometimes creates a sad history on a global scale.
Okay, so I hope you enjoyed that. I just want to end by reading you a short summary just so that we get the actual casualties sorted out. That American colonel said that you had about 800 German tanks facing about 3,000 Soviet tanks. But just remember that I think it was Zhukov, he sent 5,000 tanks to attack the Germans. But due to breakdowns and various problems on the Russian side, only about 3,000 reached them. So I found one German article that was written in German, and the translation is here, and this helps to clarify some of these numbers. So according to that, it says the German troops faced 6 mechanized corps. Numerically, the Soviets were far superior with 3,298 tanks to 808 German tanks. Okay, so almost 3,300 Soviet tanks reached the 800 German tanks. Then it continues, according to military historian Roman Topper, who I assume is a German, there were numerous engagements that did not involve tanks on the German side. The Germans also used artillery and anti-aircraft guns against tanks. The so-called 8.8 flak was also used here. Due to its tall build, it was not an optimal anti-tank weapon. In other words, it was big and bulky and easy to see. But even so, it was used. But it could even destroy the enemy's T-34 and KV-1 at ranges of over 2,000 meters. According to Topol, the Soviet troops lost 2,000 tanks, while the Germans lost only 85 main battle tanks and 5 to 10 command vehicles. So, returning to what the American colonel said, he assumed that the Germans lost 300 to 350 tanks, while he said most of the Soviet tanks were wiped out. I, at the time, took it to mean all of them were wiped out, which is not true. So, by looking at what the American colonel said, we could have said that the outcome is 300 to 350 losses on the German side versus 2,000 losses on the Russian side. That would be a pretty good ratio. But according to this, I assume, German historian, he's saying that the Germans lost less than 100 vehicles. That if you take 85 main battle tanks and 10 command vehicles, and you slap it together, you get 95 vehicles. So it could be that the Soviets lost 2,000 tanks, while the Germans lost less than 100. That would seem to be correct. But if you go onto Wikipedia or any other place where the English and the Jews have had a chance to fuck with the numbers, you'll get other numbers. You won't see these impressive results. If you look at any other books or articles or Wikipedia, you'll see that they've fudged the numbers even more. They've gone and fudged all those numbers so that the number of vehicles who arrived was smaller, the number of German losses were pushed up, the Russian losses were pushed down. Now, the whole thing's been fudged, okay? At the very least, you can take what the American colonel says, and that American colonel has written several books on the war in the East. He's an absolute specialist. He's the best American non-German specialist on that war. So even if he says they destroyed most for the loss of 300, that's still closer to the truth than all the other gobbledygook and garbage you'll find on Wikipedia and everywhere else. But this German, who seems to have done much more detailed study, he says that the Germans lost less than 100 tanks. So I think that the final call is, we can say, almost 3,300 Soviet tanks, fought 800 German tanks. 2,000 of the Soviets were wiped out for less than 100 of the Germans. And that's my final word on that tank battle. But Jews and liberals and just assorted Anglo garbage won't want you to know about that. The Germans won other victories. As I have dug and looked into the Eastern Front from time to time, I come across things and I say to myself, good Lord, why isn't this on the front page of every book on military history? Look at what the Germans did here. Look at what the Germans did there. And all of it is just fantastic, insane, awesome stuff that the Germans did. Stuff that's so incredible, your jaw will drop. And it happened in Russia. And all these wise asses and weaklings and Jews are just busy trying to downplay the fantastic achievements of Hitler and the German army. The soldiers, the generals, incredible stuff. The greatest war in the history of the world. The greatest war ever fought by white men. If there's any war that white men should study, it's freaking this thing. Because there's no war that was bigger, more brutal, more determined than this war. And the Germans acquitted themselves in this war in every freaking way. I think what I'll also just add in are some final words for some of the German allies. You had the Finns who joined the Germans in the continuation war. You had some Italians fighting there. You even had the Spanish Blue Division. And I stand to be corrected, but I almost think the Spanish Blue Division may have marched from Spain to Russia. I think. Not sure whether they actually had vehicles, but the Spanish Blue Division went and fought there. However, the greatest allies of the Germans in the East were the Romanians. If there's one little white army and one smaller white nation that gave it their everything on the side of the Germans, it's the Romanians. And we should never forget the Romanians. The Romanians, their entire army was fighting for the Germans all the time. And they did their best. They weren't as good as the Germans, but they freaking fought everywhere. And they are the one ally that nobody talks about. And they really tried, the Romanians. So later on, when we discuss Barbarossa and the Eastern War, I want to tell you, if it wasn't for the freaking Americans, Jews, and British who went and massively helped the Soviets, most of what is today Ukraine, Belarus, Russia, Georgia, all those pieces of what used to be the Russian Empire. If it wasn't for the freaking Americans especially, the Jews and the Americans, and to a lesser extent, but also the freaking British, if those buggers hadn't gone and helped the Soviet Union massively, insanely, literally replacing their entire air force, their entire army, multiple times, if they hadn't helped those Russians and Soviets to insane levels, then Europe today would have stretched from the borders of Europe today, and Eastern Europe would have stretched right up to Moscow, to past Moscow. And if you were to go to Russia today and draw a line from Moscow all the way south to the Caucasus, all of that today would have been Germania, would have been an extension of Europe. That is what we lost. Thanks to Jews, Americans especially, and the ever idiotic British. It was very doable, very doable. The truth of the matter is that the Soviets, Jewish Bolshevik Soviet Union, was absolutely incapable of stopping the Wehrmacht. Those 3 million infantry troops with their small tanks, they would have conquered the greatest freaking piece of territory that Europe has ever expanded into, and today it would be Germania, and Europe would have been the greatest superpower on the face of the earth. They would have had all the insane wealth of half of Russia, and most of those Russians would be living in Europe today. The whole thing was stuffed up by Jews and the Americans. Jews and the Americans were the prime ones who cocked it up. The British also helped as much as they could. Their ability just wasn't as great as that of the Americans. Wait until you see the numbers. You'll be horrified by what happened. Be horrified by what happened. And all these people who say, oh, Hitler was an idiot, Hitler was a fool. Junk. They knew what they were doing and they would have won. It was cocked up by the Jews, the Americans, and the ever stupid British. That's the truth. That is how the Germans lost in the East. They didn't lose because the Russians were going to crush them. No, they were going to clean the Russians' clocks. Even with them not reaching Moscow in their first year, they would have cleaned the Russians' clocks. When you see the vast, vast quantities of weapons that were sent to the Russians, then you'll understand how it was that the Russians survived. It was the Americans primarily, actually, who lost the war in the East for the European race. That's a fact. We'll return to World War II in bits and pieces and look at odds and sods here and there. And then you'll really appreciate what was freaking lost. So disgusting. Instead of having blacks running rampant over Europe today, we would have had whites freaking all over Ukraine, Russia, expanding with all kinds of natural resources, oil and gas up to their freaking eyeballs, all kinds of mines and resources that were sitting there. All of it would have been part of a Nazi European Union. Anyway, the whole topic of World War II is so disgusting when you see how these idiots worked against Hitler. It's so disgusting, the whole outcome. What a freaking mess. But you can't blame the Germans, you can't blame the Italians, can't blame the Romanians, can't blame the Finns. They fought with everything they had. They fought for all they were worth.
So for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know, you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites. We gave you Breaking Bad and all the songs by Creed, all the cast of Friends and trash like Tara Reid, a virtual world of porn so you can spill your seed. Ray-Ban glasses, leggy blondes with tiny asses, frisbee sports and fancy coffee too, energy efficient lights. And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites.
Thank the whites, you know you don't.